چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام، چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
وقتی شخصیت امیرالمومنین رو بشناسه در مقابل او خضوع میکند.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
What I would like to talk is about the method of studying Nahjul Balagha, because the focus is to know Amir al-Mu'mineen and his greatest, his fazilat of ilm, to get in touch with that knowledge, that sea of knowledge of Ali, and one way is to know what he said and what he wrote. And the most famous source is Nahjul Balagha. Now, when you study Nahjul Balagha, there are two ways of studying it. One is basically this, the sequence of the book. You start with the first khutbah, and then the second, and then the third, until you go to 240 or 39 khutbahs. Then you go to the second section, starting with the letters of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and then you end with the last one, which has the sayings of Amir al-Mu'mineen. But that's kind of a tedious way of looking at it. Another method of studying Nahjul Balagha is the thematic method, where you choose a topic and then study that topic in the various sermons and letters and sayings of the Imam. So you take a topic like Tawheed, for example, and you study whatever Ali has said in different parts of Nahjul Balagha about Tawheed. Or you look at the issue of justice, or taqwa, or charity, or imamat, and other themes. The second method of Nahjul Balagha, which is the thematic approach, is actually more suited for the modern mind. You know, they want to be more focused on one topic, and that's what is appealing to them. Alhamdulillah, we have scholars who have done work on this. One of the greatest scholars of our time was Shaheed Murtaza Mutahiri. He actually has a book known as Sayri Dar Nahjul Balagha in Farsi, where he has selected different themes, and then he had studied Nahjul Balagha based on the themes that he has selected. For example, the first chapter is about the book and the compiler himself. Then he talks about theology and divinity, about Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, what Ali has to say. Then he talks about spirituality and the different levels of spirituality, how Amir al-Mu'mineen has presented this theme. Then he goes on to the chapter on governance and justice, how Ali, you know, viewed the system of government and the principle of justice in it. Then he has a chapter on Ahlul Bayt and Khilafat, whatever Ali has said about the issue of Khilafat and Ahlul Bayt. And then he comes to, you know, moral and ethical advice on different issues, ending with the issue of Zuhud. Zuhud means, you know, our relationship with dunya, with this world, and this tendency of being inclined towards materialism. And so this is a very, you know, good way of studying Nahjul Balagha, written by a contemporary Shia scholar of a very high status. Thank you.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Strikes, protests, and parliamentary disunity have shown that opposition to President Emmanuel Macron's pandemic policies have reached unprecedented levels. Macron dominates his party, and his party dominates Parliament. But France's controversial new vaccine smart pass was only just approved after more than 2 weeks of parliamentary chaos. It's one of the strictest vaccine passes in the world because it requires full vaccination. The vaccine hesitant can no longer provide proof of a negative COVID test to avoid almost total public isolation. There have been weeks of protests in favor of the rights of the non-vaccinated, and unions are planning enormous walkouts against a pandemic response which is accused of being imposed from above and without enough grassroots input.
In the end, it was Macron who decided alone, and that's why it's a bit confused for everyone. And that's why it makes a lot of confusion in the population, because just one guy who decides everything and a scientific committee who is more a justification for the decision that has been taken.
Vaccines in France are popular. 80% of the formerly vaccine skeptical nation is now fully vaccinated. That has many saying that seemingly scapegoating the unvaccinated is a way for Macron to solidify a precarious re-election bid.
Despite his immensely controversial tenure, Macron retains a hardcore base of support of around 20%. It's been long assumed that it will be enough to get him into the second round, where he will defeat a challenger from the far right, like in 2017.
The decision is very influenced by the fact that the election are coming in April. So it's really difficult to go to the mandatory vaccination for Emmanuel Macron. Maybe he want to wait for his re-election to go from the vaccinal pass to the mandatory vaccination.
The vaccine pass will likely be contested in France's top court, but it is expected to go into effect this week. The Omicron variant is far less deadly than previous versions, giving hope that the pandemic is ending. But it appears that the nation's pandemic policies will be a major part of the presidential election this April. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
Genocide, the deliberate destruction of an ethnic, national, racial, or religious group. There have been many, with death tolls in the millions, and the threat of another is always around the corner. Organizations like the IHRC are fighting to prevent that by raising awareness. The theme of this year's event, how do states sanitize genocide?
Genocide is sanitized. It's not only the genocidal state which actively attempts to sanitize its crimes. Other states are also actively involved. Those which supply the weapons and other instruments of annihilation. Those which refuse to acknowledge or call out the genocide for fear of the obligations to prevent and punish the crimes taking place that they would be placed under. Those which fear offending trading partners.
There are more than 1,500 monuments across London commemorating everyone from controversial figures like Churchill to even fictional characters like Sherlock Holmes. But you would be hard-pressed to find a monument that commemorated the 1 million people killed in the Great Irish Famine, a genocide orchestrated by the British.
The British government conveniently omits England's role in bringing about genocides like the so-called potato famine from school books, like many other regimes that weave history in a way that justifies crimes against humanity.
Here's a real chance for the UK government and the Department for Education to truly celebrate, or rather I should say commemorate, the diverse groups of people that it can encourage our systems and our schools to remember because of who their predecessor governments have exterminated in previous centuries. Whether we're talking about the indigenous people of Australia, Malays, Chinese, Indian subcontinent, Iranians, Iraqis.
Genocide Memorial Day is held on the anniversary of Israel's Operation Cast Lead in 2008 to 2009, which killed hundreds of Palestinians. Again in 2021, thousands of Palestinians were killed at the hands of the Israeli regime, which legitimizes its actions by evoking another genocide, the Holocaust. The vicious cycle continues, and therefore, so must the fight against dehumanization and ethnic cleansing. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The Yemeni army and its allied Ansarullah forces have hit the heart of the United Arab Emirates, with officials in Abu Dhabi confirming two fire incidents near storage facilities of an oil firm and the city's international airport. It came just days after the Yemeni army repelled an attack by Emirati-backed mercenaries in the province of Ma'rib, killing and injuring dozens. In a statement, the Yemeni army says Monday's attack inside the UAE was a warning to stop its involvement in the Saudi-led war on the country. Earlier this month, the Yemeni army released footage of a captured UAE-flagged vessel, which had trespassed into the country's territorial waters. Army spokesman Yahya Sari said the ship was carrying military equipment and was engaged in hostile acts against Yemen. The UAE joined the Saudi-led coalition in 2015 in order to reinstate a friendly regime in Yemen. In April 2018, the Emirates deployed its military to Socotra, an island that overlooks the strategic Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route connecting the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. 2 weeks later, Saudi troops were also deployed there, a move the Yemenis described as a coup against legitimacy. The UAE had largely scaled down its military presence in Yemen in 2019, but continued funding, arming, and training mercenaries in support of separatists in southern Yemen. It became quite clear when forces loyal to former Yemeni government, aided by UAE-backed brigades and Saudi warplanes, reclaimed the oil and gas-rich southern province of Shatwa earlier this month and made advances toward Ma'rib province. However, the Yemeni army's repeated retaliatory drone and missile attacks inside Saudi Arabia and now in the UAE show the coalition is losing the momentum. It has also inflicted heavy losses on Saudi and Emirati-backed militias operating inside the country. Since last year, the Yemeni army, along with Ansarullah forces, have liberated nearly 20,000 square kilometers of land in several large-scale operations. Nearly 7 years of bombing campaigns and blockade on Yemen have proved fruitless for Saudi Arabia and some of its regional and international allies, including the U.S., as they fail to achieve their intended goals. On the other hand, Yemen's armed forces and the popular comedies have grown stronger against the invaders and give them crushing response to their deadly mayhem in the impoverished nation.
For Afghan students, the year 2021 was full of obstacles. The educational system was disrupted and many schools across remained closed, while a ban on girls returning to secondary schools is still in place.
Now the Philomoy School has opened for students in Afghanistan to facilitate learning. This online platform provides Afghan students with free educational courses.
Samira and Fatima are students of secondary school. After being banned from attending their classes, they decided to join online courses. Now they are students of Philomoy School and they are happy with everything it has provided.
It has been almost 152 days that we have been away from school. We felt very desperate. In order to stay involved with education, my friends and I gather here and benefit from Philemo School's online courses. The lessons and videos provided by Philemo are very interesting and creative.
Teachers and educational consultants believe that online courses are a good means of learning, especially at a time of crisis and pandemic. Mahdi Ishaqi, who is an education consultant, has found Philemo Online School very professional and useful for Afghan students.
I found the Philemo School extraordinarily useful, especially for Afghan students who are affected by a political crisis and the coronavirus pandemic. This is very valuable academically too. I'm sure our students highly welcome Philemo School because they are in need of such opportunities.
Philemo School says it has provided the service to Afghan students because of their difficult educational conditions. So now every Afghan boy and girl from preschool to the ninth grade can access the same lessons as Iranians do. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Bedouin Palestinians have been living in the Nakab Desert for decades, even before the creation of Israel. It's home to tens of thousands of residents who view these lands as privately owned. Still, Israel has refused to recognize these Palestinian inhabitants and is now claiming that the lands have been registered and belong to the Israeli regime. The latest incursion into Bedouin territories gave rise to a fresh round of escalation, with angry Palestinians turning out, saying the Israeli forestation project is not but an excuse to force them out of their land.
The goal of the tree planting is to prevent the expansion of the Bedouin villages, to prevent a future recognition in our villages, and this action is somewhat political. The extreme right wing used it to spoil the relationship between Jews and Arabs in this place. We say to them, this is our land, these are our villages, we've been here for hundreds and thousands of years, and we will simply not move from this place.
The crackdown turned violent in no time, with Israeli forces targeting the Palestinian demonstrators with all they had, from rubber-coated bullets and tear gas to stun grenades and skunk water. Palestinian families have been living in constant fear and apprehension due to Israel's forced displacements. A controversial case has been the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. Israel has for some time been seeking the expulsion of several Palestinian families from their houses in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, in what pro-Palestine groups have been seeing as the continuation of Israel's attempts at ethnic cleansing and Judaization of Palestinian territories. And the regime's demolition of Palestinian residences and businesses has turned into an almost daily occurrence. Palestinians say settlements built on occupied territory will get in the way of them building their future state. They have demanded that Israel freeze all settlement activity if it wants the peace process to resume. But Israel is pushing ahead, taking no heed of those demands. Some experts believe Israel has been planning from the start to expand and perpetuate its occupation, and the two-state solution was never an option for the Tel Aviv to begin with.
Well, there was never a plan for a future Palestinian state. A two-state solution, so-called, is not a solution. It's a delusion, and it's an illusion that was instituted by Ben-Gurion in the 1920s.
All these developments take place as the international community plays the role of a silent witness of the Israeli colonial policies. And all these Palestinian pleas for help and justice are falling on deaf ears. That has many wondering what can be done to make the world quit its role as a silent observer of the injustice that's been committed against Palestinians.
On Friday, EU foreign affairs and defense ministers concluded 2 days of talks, which were dominated by the subject of Russia. They assert Moscow is preparing to invade Ukraine.
Any further military aggression against Ukraine will have massive consequences and severe costs in response. And this includes restrictive measures that will be adopted in coordination with our partners.
Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Moscow's patience with the West has expired. The Kremlin demands an end to NATO's military buildup close to its borders, and any idea of Ukraine joining the alliance to be ruled out. We have been asking EU citizens to give their views on the crisis.
There will always be tensions, as long as people have different views and are standing in their views.
Just communication and dialogue, that always helps.
I mean, Russia has got an enormous nuclear arsenal. We don't. Well, Europe doesn't. So we have to, you know, tread carefully.
I think we don't need any more conflict, no?
They should just find a middle way to live with each other and don't start a war.
We don't need any war. Of course not. We want peace, all of us.
The EU has donated more than 12 billion euro to the Ukrainian government since 2014. A European Court of Auditors report published last September showed how corruption in the country is rife at the highest levels. During their talks, EU foreign affairs ministers also discussed ongoing efforts to try and get the Iran nuclear deal back on track. France's Jean-Yves Le Drian told journalists after the meeting that negotiations in Vienna are moving much too slowly and a decision must be reached. But back to Russia, and the ministers claim they want more constructive dialogue with Moscow. But impartial analysts are asking, how can they be serious amid relentless anti-Russia rhetoric and the ongoing implementation of sanctions? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
On Saturday, Rome, Milan and Naples, Italy's largest cities, saw protesters railing against the vaccine passports that are now required to access much of public life. The largest demonstration was held in the Italian capital, Rome, where over 5,000 people gathered in iconic St. John's Square to express their anger at the Mario Draghi government's latest COVID restrictions. The new law has expanded the scope of the National Health Pass, which now can only be obtained through vaccination or recovery from the infection. Italy's public transport, restaurants, hotels, museums, gyms and leisure places are required to check the pass before providing their services to the citizens.
We are not against the vaccine. My daughters and I have been vaccinated. Furthermore, we don't hold it against the Italian fellow citizens who got vaccinated. It was their choice and we respect it. We are sick and tired of being considered just numbers for statistics. We're human beings, citizens, with our rights and freedoms.
The organizers of the protest say they are not supporting the no-vax movement, but are very concerned over the socio-economic consequences of the restrictions. Thousands of small and medium-sized companies that make up the bulk of the Italian economy have been forced to shut down due to the coronavirus lockdowns.
Retailers, shopkeepers, everybody knows full well that the new restrictions will hit them even harder. Scientific experts have explained that the vaccine offers partial protection against transmission or of infection from the virus. This green pass is just a way to control us.
Despite Italy recording over 180,000 COVID-related cases on Saturday, the daily number of reported coronavirus infections in Italy has begun to fall in recent days. However, scientific experts say the Omicron wave has not peaked just yet.
On top of the pandemic's socioeconomic effects, Italy is bracing for the upcoming presidential election. Lawmakers will elect the country's next president on January 24, with current Prime Minister Mario Draghi among the contenders. The possibility of a government crisis cannot be ruled out. Max Civili, Rome.
The U.S. levied sanctions on six North Korean officials and two organizations following Washington's rebukes of Pyongyang at the United Nations. North Korea conducted several ballistic missile tests over the past week, including two Friday afternoon. But North Korea's ally China believes the sanctions raise tension. Since sanctions began 15 years ago, North Korea has developed a credible nuclear threat. Pyongyang argues that it has a right to self-defense in the face of U.S. hostility, which includes military exercises of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. The U.S.-led U.N. Security Council sanctions against North Korea seek to encourage Pyongyang to negotiate denuclearization.
The UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea are being carried out mainly by the US and Japan, along with several other countries. Hence, if the US and Japan truly seek the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, they should stop sanctions and conduct dialogue and diplomacy with North Korea.
South Korea also favors sanctions relief for North Korea, with its unification ministry Friday vowing to continue efforts at providing humanitarian aid. South Korea has also called for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War, although the U.S. has shown little interest. South Korean President Moon Jae-in has made repeated attempts to bring the U.S. and North Korea together for meaningful dialogue. But with Moon's term set to expire this May, this last round of U.S. sanctions will likely deal a final blow to President Moon's peace-building efforts. Frank Smith, Seoul.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, idea of India, which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accused the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. I mean, it is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS, and so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Lawmakers, congressional staffers, and strategists predict a slew of investigations targeting the Biden administration, particularly if Republicans loyal to former President Donald Trump gain important committee seats in U.S. Congress after midterm elections in November. We have prepared for you an article written jointly by Jeff Mason and Jared Renshaw. The piece is titled, Another Midterm Worry for Biden White House, Probes and Impeachment Attempts. U.S. midterm elections are some 10 months away, but President Joe Biden's administration and allies already foresee a possible scenario in which Republicans take the House of Representatives, the Senate, or both, and launch a series of investigations and attempts to impeach the president. Lawmakers, congressional staffers, and strategists predict a slew of investigations targeting the Biden administration, particularly if Republicans loyal to former President Donald Trump gain important committee seats in U.S. Congress. Those seeking to pursue investigations include House Republicans Matt Gaetz, who pledged in a podcast to target the Department of Justice until sphincters tighten; Bob Gibbs, who has been pushing to impeach Joe Biden since September over the Afghanistan pullout; and James Comer, a hopeful to become head of the House Oversight Committee. Comer's office said his targets include the president's son, Hunter Biden, the administration's handling of supply chain issues and vaccine mandates, and its removal of Trump Military Academy appointees. The White House has already taken small steps that will help shield the administration from aggressive probes. It hired a special advisor, former New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu, to oversee the implementation of the $1 trillion infrastructure law, which Republicans would likely scrutinize in search of fraud. The White House also bolstered the legal counsel's office with a longtime Democratic communications official to help with fallout from the chaotic U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan last year. One team member said Biden's transition team, after his 2020 election win, formed the White House counsel's office in anticipation of Republicans winning the Senate and pursuing investigations. The January 2021 runoff election in Georgia left control of the body to Democrats instead, but the counsel's office still has that legal firepower. Andy Wright, director of the legal policy for the transition team, said, "We had every reason to believe that it was going to be a Republican Senate. That was built into the original planning. That planning included having Jonathan Soo, who had experience handling investigations in the Obama White House years, serving as Joe Biden's deputy counsel." Strategists said the Biden White House may hire new researchers, lawyers, and communications officials to focus on the probes. Ben LaBolt, a former Obama spokesman, said the Clinton and Obama White Houses assembled teams of roughly the same size and expertise as congressional committees pursuing investigations. He said, "You need to have a parallel structure at the White House that's capable of anticipating those attacks and responding to those attacks." An advisor said, "Joe Biden plans to travel to states with key political races this year, and the White House hopes Democrats will maintain majorities in Congress on the back of his COVID-19 vaccination rollout and legislative achievements." The Democratic National Committee is expected to spend heavily in contested races in states such as Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania that will also be important in 2024. Schultz, a senior advisor to former President Barack Obama, who was brought in as a spokesman in the Obama White House to deal with investigations then, said if the Republicans do win this November, they're going to run the same play they did in 2011, but it will be even more unhinged and less credible. Richard Painter, former associate counsel under Republican President George W. Bush, said they'll subpoena everything under the sun. Among the issues, Republicans could look into the Justice Department's investigation of the deadly 6th of January riot on the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters and thwart the congressional investigation into the attack if it's still ongoing. Referring to 6th of January, Republican Senator Matt Gaetz said, "We're going to go after this administrative state, and we're going to start at the Department of Justice and the FBI." Outlays from the COVID-19-related $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan and the infrastructure law, both unpopular with Republicans, despite some bipartisan support for the latter, also would likely be scrutinized. Amy Koch, a Republican strategist in Minnesota who helped state and federal candidates get elected, said, "There's no doubt Republican lawmakers are going to pore over documents, and all this spending will see unprecedented scrutiny. Some Republicans have already signaled an appetite for impeaching Joe Biden, with a group of four led by Gibbs filing articles of impeachment over immigration on the U.S. border with Mexico and for the way U.S. troops were removed from Afghanistan." Gibbs is joined by House Republicans Andy Biggs, Brian Babin, and Randy Weber. Separately, Marjorie Taylor Greene, a pro-Trump firebrand, filed articles of impeachment the day after Joe Biden was sworn into office. A Republican congressional staffer with ties to leadership said, "There will be a lot of pressure on Kevin McCarthy, if he's Speaker, to pursue impeachment of Biden from day one. He may not have much of a choice if he wants to retain his title." Kevin McCarthy is online to succeed Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi if Republicans take over control of the chamber. During the 2020 election, Joe Biden's son, Hunter, became a target of Donald Trump and Republicans, who alleged wrongdoing when he served on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. A Ukrainian review found no evidence of wrongdoing. Richard Painter predicted, "There will be a lot of this Hunter Biden stuff, and a lot of it is going to be unfair to Biden, and a lot of it is going to be personal." U.S. House Democrats twice impeached Donald Trump, once over Ukraine and again on his actions ahead of the 6th of January riot, but he was acquitted by the Republican-controlled Senate on both occasions. Moreover, just a few days before U.S. President Joe Biden celebrates his first full year in the White House, half of the Americans say they are frustrated with his presidency. According to a CBS News survey released on Sunday, 16th of January, half of the respondents said they were frustrated and disappointed by Joe Biden's presidency. A majority of people surveyed in the opinion poll appeared to be not optimistic about the current state of their country. About three-fourths of the respondents said they felt that the United States was doing somewhat or very badly in a general sense. Most of the American public said that they disapproved of the way Democratic president was handling the economy. Issues like immigration, race relations, crime, inflation, policing, and Afghanistan. The poll surveyed 2,094 American adults and was conducted from 12th to 14th of January. The results have a margin of error of plus or minus 2.5 percentage points. Joe Biden's approval rating has been on the decline in recent weeks, hovering in the low 40s and even the high 30s in opinion polls. According to a USA Today and Suffolk University survey carried out in November, Joe Biden's approval rating has slipped to 38 percentage points. Democrats are worried that Joe Biden's sinking approval rating will cost them their slim majorities in Congress in this year's midterm elections. According to a report by the website Politico, with historical midterm headwinds and a Republican-led redistricting effort already at work, many U.S. Democrats fear that unless their party leader reverses his current slide, Congress will be handed over to the Republicans in 2022. Another recent opinion poll finds that 71% of Republicans believe Joe Biden's victory in the November 2020 presidential election was illegitimate. The University of Massachusetts at Amherst poll showed that only 11% of respondents considered Joe Biden's victory probably legitimate.
WIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is the program Viewpoints, and in this series, produced by Brother Mahmoud, we are concerned with an analysis on the thoughts and opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on different occasions and different topics. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, two experts from the Islamic House of Qom, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
You're welcome. I'm Brother Ali Alavian. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam and thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, brother. So this is the continuation on the series regarding the important topic, pure Muhammadan Islam or Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, based on the speeches of Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We enumerated some of the features of this type of Islam we are concerned with, and we said that the main cause and goal of the Islamic revolution of Iran to take place was a kind of revival to this concept, Islam and Nabi Muhammadi, or pure Muhammadan Islam. So according to the leader of Iran, pure Muhammadan Islam is Sayyid Mohsen, is a kind of Islam that is based on the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Prophet Muhammad. It is not a religion of superstition, deviation, extremism, or some of the attributes that are nowadays, unfortunately, in the media, we can say, used as a label for Islam, radical Islam, Islamism. These are the terms that are used nowadays when you are Googling the term Islam, or we can say Islamophobia also, we can say, which is a fear of Islam. When we say Islam and pure Muhammadan Islam based on the Sunnah and the Holy Quran, what do we mean exactly? So we have some important pillars in Islam that are accepted by all. These are the causes of the unity, as Rahbar also said. But the main question is, if we are not going to accept Islam through the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, what will be the repercussions, Brother Ali, the consequences for the Muslims?
I think we need to clarify some points here first. I believe that the leader of the Islamic Ummah, when he talks about the Sunnah and Quran and he asks us to follow the real Sunnah, he is not actually insisting actually wants others to follow whatever we follow, whatever we understand. But
we mean Shia, is it?
Yeah, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. But he wants to make us, actually, this is my understanding. We have a criteria. Our criteria is Quran. Let's base whatever we understand from the Sunnah with Quran. If it goes with Quran, it is okay.
Okay.
We can accept it.
Okay.
Look, whatever Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam say, they are exactly 100% based on the Quran. We cannot find anything saying by Ahlul Bayt or said by Ahlul Bayt, and it is against Quran. So we have, at least we have one common thing.
Okay.
And even Ahlul Bayt to some extent actually is have been accepted, as the brother said, by some other Islamic sects. I don't want to mention any of them specifically. So when we have a criteria, then we can act upon that and go. So in this criteria, we have some bases in Quran. We have some rules in Quran. Based on those rules, we can follow exactly and see what the Prophet understood and what the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam told us. We see that we can reach to an agreement, to a convergence in Islam.
Sorry, Brother Ali, let me disagree you over here.
Tell me.
When you looked at the different magazines and the, we can say, letters and the news produced by ISIS, they said that our understanding is exactly based on the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
And the Sunnah Prophet
Quran
Muhammad.
Interpreted by whom?
Okay, this is the problem. This is my question now. Now, I do want to say, and they were, we can't say, attracting so many people by this type of understanding, okay? So, and they were gaining power.
This is what we are going to do now.
This is the ideological.
We want to tell them what kind of understanding of Quran is true.
And based on that, different interpreters from the other sources, from the other religions, have criticized Islam that, look, this is the real Islam they are referring to based on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say, mere understanding the Holy Quran or reciting it for long, long times in our prayer and salas does not bring us any kind of recognition of the true meaning of the Quran. This is what, unfortunately, some of the sects inside Islam do, and they say, okay, Holy Quran, a revelation from Allah, so our understanding based on that is absolutely true, so let's recite it, let's recite long surahs from it, and doing this and doing that. A parrot-like imitation out of the sunnah, of the prophetic sunnah. The main question is this: if we are not going to be trapped by these, we can say, deceptions, I mean, the Islam that is the Islam of innovation and superstition, and we want to get back to the main sources and the original Islam. This is, let me repeat my question again. To whom shall we refer in the 21st century?
Look, brother, you said that...
All of the people do not have time to go to the Ahlul Bayt books and read them, or read Nahjul Balagha or Sahifa, or do this or do that, brother.
Yeah, right. But you said that the understanding of Quran is not enough. If understanding of Quran is not enough, so what is the good of Quran then?
This is my question.
So I mean,
mere understanding of the Quran is not enough. I mean, practicing it is something else, isn't it?
Yeah. I want to say, first, in order to practice, you need to understand it first.
Okay.
So understanding and the basis of, for example, some rules and rules of understanding Quran. I mean, you cannot enter a notion and I want to dive into this ocean and capture it and do whatever I can. No, the Quran is an ocean. So for understanding how to dive into it, how to be with it, how to benefit from it.
Okay.
So you need to have some guidelines. Who is giving you the guidelines?
Uh-huh.
So we need to define those people, those who can give us a good understanding, good enlightenment from the Quran.
So everybody from different sects of Muslim will say, I am the experts of the Quran.
Yes, but the Prophet said, who is the real interpreter of the Quran? Who is this on the same weight of the Quran? They are the Ahlul Bayt. So this is what what he frequently said, mm-hmm. and it is accepted by both sects, by different sects in Islam. In Islam world, they have all accepted that the Prophet said that talking Quran? These are the Ahlul Bayt. So they are the ones who can define and interpret Quran in the right way that we are after.
Okay.
So Quran, in this sense, is a good criteria for
us. Let's have Said Mohsen commenting on what you said.
Someone can argue that these are the hadith that are near Shia. Is Quran enough for us or not? That's the discussion. Okay. That's the new question.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need someone with the Quran or not? Because it is said like the Quran itself is enough. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Quran, verse number, I just mentioned Surah chapter Tawbah, verse number 119.
This is what Khawarij said. Khawarij said that Quran is enough for us.
So in
Said Mohsen is also commenting on that. He says Quran is not enough.
I'm bringing the proof that Quran is not enough on its own.
Okay.
Yeah. And did you get that?
Yeah, yeah.
You said that he's saying Quran is enough for us?
No, I thought that Said under. I mean,
why Quran is not enough on its own.
Said is trying to explain why the Holy Quran is not enough.
Go ahead. Sorry for interruption.
Chapter Tawbah, verse number 119. Allah says, "Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu taqullaha wa kunu ma'as sadiqin." I mentioned this verse in the beginning of the program
Yes, that's right.
If you look at the interpretation of tafsir, for example, on one hand, Brother Alaviyan has mentioned the narrations of the Prophet regarding Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
Does intellect also order us to this or not?
Mm-hmm.
Does intellect or aql also agrees on this or not?
Okay.
One of the greatest scholars amongst the Ahl Sunnah is Fakhr Razi.
That's right.
Who was the great scholar and the philosopher and the theologist, you can say, like amongst the Ahl Sunnah. In his Tafsir Kabir, he mentions under this verse, and he argues, what is this? Basically, in this Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is ordering, oh, the believers, ya ayyuhalladhina amanu. He's talking to the believers. He says to the believers, ittaqullah. This ittaqullah is obviously following the Quran in order to get the taqwa of Allah. Wa kunu ma'as sadiqin, and be with the rightful people.
That's right.
Now he argues here, he says that Allah did not mention the believers of the time of the Prophet or after him. he generally talked about all the believers. Mm-hmm. It means that this verse mentions, covers the believers until the Qiyamah, till the day of judgment. So all the believers who will come till the Qiyamah are under this verse. Number one. Number two, when Allah is talking with the believers and he say, be with the truthful ones, mm-hmm. so that truthful one should be someone who is higher in rank than the believers.
Than the believers, very good.
Because obviously believers, they are praying, they are not committing sins. That's why we call them mu'min. Now here we have the difference between Muslim and mu'min. Mu'min is highest rank in the Islam.
Okay.
A person who does not commit any kind of sin and he is following all the rules of the Islam. So he argues that because Allah is talking to the mu'mineen, to the real believers who do not commit sin, the one who can be above them, to whom Allah will say, like, you believers need to follow this truthful person, he should be above them. Mm-hmm. He shouldn't be equal to them. Otherwise,
so there's a hierarchy over here.
There's a hierarchy.
That's right, very good.
So there, if this hierarchy wasn't there, Allah should say, oh, mu'mineen, follow the mu'mineen.
Uh-huh.
Allah did not say follow the mu'mineen. Okay. He said truthful.
That's all right.
On the next step, third step, he argues that this truthful people...
He is Fakhr Razi, you are referring
Fakhr
to.
Fakhr Razi, yes. He said that these truthful people must be infallible. Now, there's a difference between mu'min and infallible. Infallible who from his birth does not commit any sin.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the prophets are infallible. The A'imma ayatat here refers to the infallibility of the A'imma. So he argues there that these truthful people must be infallible. They are, because they are higher in rank than the mu'mineen.
Okay.
And mu'mineen are the followers of the infallible.
So does Fakhr Razi by the term ma'asum mean exactly our infallible imams?
Well, he generally talks about the infallible. They must be infallible. So till the Qiyamah, all the mu'mineen should follow an infallible person.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the order of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And if someone does that, he must, in order to get the Quran or taqwa ilahi, we can say like the taqwa of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he needs to follow an infallible. Now, the answer is, and obviously we say we have the answer, who are those infallibles?
Uh-huh.
Even Ahlul Sunnah know that, who are the infallibles. The Ahlul Bayt are the infallible.
That's right.
And in the Quran we have that, Allah said like, if you want to give the reward for what the Prophet have done, you need to love the Ahlul Bayt. Mawaddat Ahlul Bayt.
Yes, okay.
So all these things are mentioned there.
Did
so basically,
did Fakhr Razi himself follow
Tafsir Kabir?
Did he himself follow the Ahlul Bayt?
Well,
because I had the same discussion said with
we are arguing
Wahhabi.
That in the Quran when we have
Islam
this verse,
Islam and Nabi Muhammadi through the true sources.
Yeah, I know.
Said is right.
Fakhr Razi in his interpretation, even under the ayah of Tathir.
We are not talking about a specific person.
Let me say one point. Under the ayah of Tathir, it says whatever Sayyid says. That actually, he proves that,
the ma'asum.
The infallibility of the Ahlul Bayt. Actually, when I raised this argument with a follower of another sect in Islam, he turned back to me and said he was a Shia. Simply. He was also a Shia. What are you saying?
That's because obviously we have this discussion with the brothers as well.
Okay.
When we talk about the Suyuti, Jalaluddin Suyuti, they say, okay, he was the follower of Ahlul Bayt. Or when we talk about Fakhr Razi, they say the same thing.
Yes.
What about Abu Hanifa?
Yes.
Imam Abu Hanifa was the follower of Ahlul Bayt. He had this belief that Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam is the bila fasl caliph.
Yes.
Like right after the Prophet, he is the successor of the Prophet.
I do want to say
Imam Hanbal had, Imam Shafi has the same. Imam Shafi has a point.
The best authenticity.
That if the love of Ahlul Bayt is kufr, is disbelieving, then I'm akfar. I'm the biggest disbeliever in the Islam.
Yeah.
So we have it. At this point, if we are talking to a specific person in a specific, we can say, follower of the specific school of thought,
even among the caliphs,
he is not authority for us.
Even if it is narrated that Omar said also that if it was not because of Ali. More than 100 times I would perish because of the answers and because of everything. I do want to say, if you want to give authenticity to one category of thought, the best, I think, answer is to extract the answers from and to extract the opinions from the opponents, of those groups. And according to what the leader said and what the Shia and Bosa Sunni says, the best interpreters of the Holy Quran have been the Ahlul Bayt themselves, and that's all. And because they have the knowledge. And we know that Among the other sects of Islam who call themselves interpreters or commentators of the Holy Quran, they have all been the students of Imam al-Baghir and Imam al-Sadiq, following those lines.
One sentence, if I can add on this. For us, the authenticity of something is what is nearest to the Prophet. In the history, we look for the books.
Okay.
For us today, if someone comes and say Fakhr al-Razi, for example, is a Shia, he's not an authentic thing for us.
Okay.
We need to look in the history.
In
history, does the ulama of Ahl Sunnah used to say like Fakhr al-Razi be their imam, Imam al-Kabir, and he had this tafasir, or Jalaluddin Suyuti, or other imams that they had? So we need to look at the history, basically.
Yes.
In history, it is proof that he was Mu'tazili, and obviously he was from that. So for us, the argument is, if today our listeners want to go and refer to the real things or the real idea about these scholars, maybe
that's right,
they need to go back to the history and look at the history, like the ones who've been approved by the ulama, their scholars, they are their scholars.
So we have to get back to the original Islam based on studying, and this is what I think the Muslim community and the Muslim youth nowadays lack, because if we do not have true understanding through studying the Holy Quran, history of Islam and the Sunnah, then the selective, we can say, understanding of the Islam can get into what Sayyid called the British Islam or the American Islam, and not the pure Mohammedan Islam.
Yes.
Thank you very much, Brother Ali Alavian.
Thanks, you.
And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, it was very kind of you. I really benefited from your discussion. And I hope that our dear listeners benefited from this series of the discussions and analysis on the thoughts and some of the most outstanding opinions of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Visit our website, parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Also our YouTube page, Call of Islam Radio. We bid farewell to you. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Sometimes I can't see where I'm supposed to go. Sometimes I speed up when I should take it slow. But through all my hard times, when I lose my way, you're concealing my mistakes, yeah. I know you're always by my side, never turning out your light. When I need you most, your stars will shine. When I'm out there in the darkest place, worn and tired, I can still see you illuminate all my skies. When it feels like I've fallen too far from you, there you are, guiding me through. Whenever I feel down, you can lift me up, turning my life around with your love. No matter how rough it gets, I can wear a smile, 'cause your mercy never dries, yeah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.